We've heard the advice not to buy or eat a food product if you can't pronounce all the ingredients. It's a simple rule of thumb, but a compelling one. Just what is some of that stuff in our food? Today's guest knows a lot about that and is quite wary of some of it. And she shares her findings and concerns in a book with a compelling title, What the Fork Are You Eating? It's written by Stephanie Sachs, who is a certified chef with a master's degree in nutrition, and that gives her the additional title of culinary nutritionist. The CNS after her name means certified nutrition specialist. The CDM means certified dietitian nutritionist. And Stephanie even hosts her own weekly radio show. Stephanie Sachs, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.
You have so much knowledge. I just wonder what you do with the bulk of your time. What represents the bulk of your work?
Oh, gosh, there's so many things that make up my work. I think the heart and soul of my work is what I do with my clients one-on-one to help them make shifts in their food lifestyle, which is what I like to call it. And I go into their homes, and I meet with them, and I take them shopping, teach them how to navigate food, make better choices. And then I cook with them, giving them the tools and the skills to be able to nourish themselves more healthfully. And everybody starts at a different place. And so that's the foundation of my work, and that's where I really collected so much information to be able to put into this book. And I've been doing that for roughly 15 years. And I also teach various places. I do workshops. And that, I would say, is the heart and soul. But I also have the radio show, and I do quite a bit of writing, which is a lot of fun. And now, of course, all the excitement with this book out.
You've really got it all from the market to the table and beyond, don't you?
Oh, my gosh. And I have two kids.
Ah, okay. So you're never unbusy, it sounds like.
I am never unbusy.
So, Stephanie, you apparently got interested in food young. Were you ever a burger lover, for example?
You know, listen, I did go to Burger King when I was a kid. My grandmother used to take me there. I think I liked the pickles more than anything else at that point. But I was never a hardcore burger lover. I think that in general, we grew up with healthy eating habits. But as a result, I also, not necessarily as a result of eating healthfully, but perhaps the environment, certain stressors, and certain foods, because I ate candy like everybody else, and I just ate like a normal kid would in the 70s, an average kid. I had terrible environmental allergies, as well as asthma, terrible asthma, and bronchitis, and recurring pneumonia. And then I had always loved to cook, and at the age of 15, I started cooking in a health food store as my summer job, and I picked up a book called Food and Healing by Anne Marie Colbin. And I had been to so many doctors. I had been on 5 different medications to be able to breathe freely. And I was like, maybe food could help me heal. That's what this lady's saying. So I started playing with my diet. And as I took the junk out and as I started to learn where food came from and how food was grown and what was put in food, and I avoided the chemicals and anything artificial, I started to feel better. And then it evolved into, 14 years ago, I took the gluten out because I have autoimmune issues. So I did a lot of shifting and really was my own lab rat for so many years, and then formalized my education with culinary school, and didn't really think at the time that I would end up going to get my master's for nutrition, but it seemed fruitless to just use my culinary education to go out and perhaps open up a little cafe, which was my original dream. I wanted to be able to help people and guide people and impart what I had learned along the way to many others. And so the only resolution for me to be able to get there was that I needed to go get a real degree in nutrition, not a certificate, not a, 6-month program and you're qualified to practice nutrition and work with people with illness. I wanted something very credible. So I went back to school in my 30s and got the degree and built this practice. I started out by cooking for people with illness and then really partnered with a lot of doctors and registered dietitians who were talking about using food to heal but could not give their patients the tools to be able to do it. And so I started working with people one-on-one, and it has grown since. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to put my knowledge down on paper.
And I noticed the use of the term practice. It's almost like a medical practice.
It is. But what's so different is I'm not working in a clinical environment. I'm going into people's homes. And so much happens in the home. When you meet someone in their comfort zone, they really relax, and so many barriers come down, and you're able to help them in a very different way.
I want to make sure we don't pigeonhole you, because, Stephanie, it's clear that you do not stand behind one particular kind of diet or one, you know, eat orange foods or anything like that.
No, God, no.
Why? I mean, but you, it's just a broader range for you?
Been there, done it. Mm-hmm. I've done it all, okay? I've done the vegan diet. I've been vegetarian. I've gone macrobiotic. I've done the blood type diet. I've done, you name it, I've done it. And in the end, it comes back to one thing for me, and it's eat a variety of healthy, whole foods, integrate processed foods, but choose wisely as needed, and consume everything in moderation. We live in a country, even in a world, where people get on these fads and these trends and these fixes, you know, whether it's a juice cleanse, whether it's Asahi, whether it's kale is the new this, or maca is the new that, and then people think that that's the panacea, the superfood panacea. And the bottom line is all of these foods are wonderful, but let's integrate them as part of a healthy diet. There is no one perfect edible pill.
So kale is the new jicama or something. So What the Fork Are You Eating is Stephanie Sachs's book. The interview is from 2015, and we will return to it on the Jefferson Exchange in just a few moments. As we head to the break, I can catch you up on where things stand with the fund drive. We just crossed $40,000, so that makes us 20% of the way toward our goal, which is not a bad place to be on day two. People are really stepping up at a time of potential challenge for funding for public media in this country, and we hope you will stand up with them as well. 888-552-6191 to phone in a pledge of support. We have volunteers waiting to take your call, very friendly volunteers, or you can just skip the volunteer thing completely and go straight to the pledge drive at ijpr.org on the web. Jefferson Exchange continues in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Stephanie Sachs is chef, nutritionist, radio host, and more. And in all of those roles, she's concerned about food. The question she often asks is also the title of her book, What the Fork Are You Eating? She visited in January 2015. There are some phone calls from that day. We can take no new ones on this day. Well, gotta love some of the internal titles in the book in addition to the overall title. Section one is top-rated Terminators. What are we looking at in this section?
So I find that there are so many books out there that talk about the problems to no end and not the solutions. So I only wanted to spend a quarter of the book talking about the problems, and that's in this section. And the top-rated Terminators are the 10 things in your food or being done to your food that are just not cool. And that's the way I phrase it. And I start off by talking about how our government, as I like to say, quote, unquote, regulates our food, because it is a bit of a joke. So people are informed as to where this information is coming from and how it's being regulated. And then I go into the 10 things. So it's everything from food dyes to artificial flavors, and flavor enhancers, trans fats, hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, GMOs, sugar and its many euphemisms. Sugar can be listed over 50 ways.
Yeah, we talked about evaporated cane juice earlier today.
Yeah, exactly. So chemical preservatives is another one. So I go through these 10 things and I talk about what they are, why they're bad, and I call on quite a bit of science that's available. And it's all referenced in the book. And then the better-for-you alternatives. Because, again, this is about solutions. So my whole message in the book is that small changes can make big everyday differences. I am a realist, not an idealist. I work with people from all walks of life. So if you can take a few pearls from this book, whether it's how you're purchasing animal foods or not buying anything that is boasting multiple claims like natural, purist, organic, and really understanding what all of these things mean and who's verifying what, these small changes can make big differences for people.
Yeah, I want to emphasize what you were just talking about. There's always a better for you alternative listed in each one of the sections on each one of the bugaboos on the top rated terminators.
Yeah.
I want to get through some of the terminators individually, but I want to come back to the food regulations part because the acronym GRAS or GRAS is a really interesting concept.
It is. It really is, isn't it? It's fascinating. It is so fascinating. So GRAS stands for generally recognized as safe. And so basically, according to the FDA, there are food additives, okay, that go into food, and there's no proven track record of safety. So these have to undergo testing by the FDA before they can be used in the food. However, there are so many ingredients in our foods today that are not defined as these additives, but they're defined as generally recognized as safe, meaning that they're deemed safe by FDA scientists for intended use based on published studies, which may be corroborated by unpublished studies and other data and information. So what does that really mean? And then that they're used in food for a long period of time with no scientifically based concerns.
So the sense of scientific peer review and things that we get where people are firing bullets at each other's research isn't quite as rigorous, it sounds like, in the food area.
No, it's not at all. And oftentimes a lot of these studies are funded by the companies who want to use these ingredients. And that's what's really frightening. There are very few studies out there that are third-party funded. So there's no interest involved in it.
After a little while of reading What the Fork Are You Eating, Stephanie, I got the sense that without multiple deaths, then a substance can be considered safe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, food dyes are one of my most favorite examples. And the Center for Science and Public Interest came out with this brilliant study several years ago called A Rainbow of Risks. And if people want to understand the dyes, what the dyes are that they're giving their kids, because kids consume multiple dyes daily if they're drinking a lot of these sports beverages or sodas or candy and cakes and cookies, even pickles, believe it or not. And these dyes are also in cosmetics. And so the studies that have been done on these dyes were for single-use dyes on an adult population, not a child population, and not multiple dyes being combined.
Ah, you mean one at a time then, rather than having... Yeah, okay, now it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very scary thing, these food dyes. And, you know, my logical question to most people is, if there's a better way to do this, you guys, why not do it the healthier way? There's enough evidence out there to question the safety of all of these things that I'm talking about in the book. So why not do it another way? And most people are like, well, we don't know what that better way is. And so I'm like, well, now you do, because you have this book. I have a list in the back, in the appendix, of, you know, more common-based food products and their better alternative counterpart.
Stephanie Sachs is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is What the Fork Are You Eating? Here's a phone call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Hear
Hi, Paul.
Hear her. That's the best thing I can say. Beyond that, you know, you are understating, in my opinion, the corruption of the certification process of food additives, of GMO products, of processes. You say FDA scientists clear it. Well, in most instances, I believe that it is, in fact, private sector firms who are hired by the individual selling the product that put these studies together. In addition to that, the length of the studies quite often, and this has been shown in GMO studies, is not long enough to show the long-term effects of exposures to these various products that are being foisted upon us. I'm pretty much back to growing my own food.
Hmm. Oh, no, and I 100% agree with you. I had to be very careful on how I distilled the information for this book, because I don't want to go out there and create more fear. There's a lot of fear around food for people. And so it's very important that when you're going out with something like this and you're educating a larger population, there are people who are like you who really see the problems at the level that I see them and have multiple concerns. I'm 100% with you. But I'm working with people who don't even understand what a food dye is as well. And so if I'm to go in and I'm to get so in detail about the corruption. You've got wonderful books out there that do that. Foodopoly is a perfect example by Winona Hodder, who's the executive director of Food and Water Watch. There are brilliant books out there.
And you mentioned Mary Nessel's books as well. We've talked to her
Mary
a couple times.
Mary Nessel, yeah. Safe food, food politics. I mean, Mary Nessel is the Madonna when it comes to this information. I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to create more fear for people. I wanted to give them pearls of information, hit the surface but go a little bit lower, and give people the tools and motivation to start to make change.
Well, there are a couple things I do and deal with specifically, though. For one thing, propylene glycol, when I see that that is still in our food, in mm-hmm. addition to being in our car radiators as antifreeze, I have to question why.
Well, absolutely. And that, and also that it's not allowed in cat food, but it's allowed in our food. And it's not allowed in Europe, but it's allowed in our food. There are a lot of things. There are a lot of things. You have a strawberry milkshake from a fast food restaurant that in Europe is colored with strawberries, but in our country it's colored with red dye.
And flavored with something other than strawberries. You know, and this is one of the specific things I like to ask people when they talk about their introduction to natural foods is what registered on your palate and your brain the first time you tasted a real strawberry versus like a strawberry milkshake or strawberry ice cream?
It's so true. And, you know, speaking of palate and sweeteners, what's so interesting, there was a study that came out of Harvard with Dr. David Ludwig, and he does a lot of obesity work, and I talk about this in the book, and that people who regularly consume artificial sweeteners, which is a large percentage of this population, actually lose the ability to tolerate the lack of sweetness in fruits and vegetables because their palates are trained to only accept foods that are so highly sweetened.
Hmm.
And that's a really, really scary thought. We're moving more towards artificial fake food than going back to the roots of real food. And I'm not saying that people have to grow their own food. I can't even grow mint, to be honest with you. And that's the big joke. I can cook up a storm, but I can't grow anything.
And that grows pretty easily, I have to admit.
It's a weed. Imagine that, right? But I literally can't grow mint. So, and it's a big joke in my family, trust me. But the reality is that I don't care what choice people are making. I want to give them the tools to know that they have a choice and that there are other options. And when people come at me and say, oh, Stephanie, it's way too expensive to eat healthfully, I say, you know what? Number one, no, it's not. And number two, do you want to pay on the back end or the front end? Because you will pay.
Stephanie Sachs is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a culinary nutritionist. She's written a book called What the Fork Are You Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. Peter in Ashland is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephanie Sachs.
Is that me?
That's you.
Hi. Well, let's see. I've got a big old clump of mint that is a weed in my yard that I'd like to give you half of.
Please.
And if you can kill it, I'll give you a gold star.
I will kill it. Trust me. I will.
Second, I wanted to just make the point on your strawberries there that even if they're just strawberries, if people knew how toxic non-organic strawberries are, they'd think twice whether or not they should eat them. And the main point I was calling about was xylitol. And I've, you know, of course, I've been aware of it for years. And one of the things that the kind of quandaries that I've always found with it is that they sometimes you'll see it stated that you should not feed it to pets, that it's dangerous for pets. And I'm wondering, okay, now how can that be dangerous for my dog, who's a mammal, and not for myself?
Mm-hmm. But it's a sweetener, right?
It's a sugar alcohol. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so take it away, Stephanie.
So it's a sugar alcohol, a non-caloric sugar alcohol. And these substances like xylitol, sorbitol, mannitol, they're being used in food as a sugar replacement. The catch here, though, is if you consume too much of them, they cause digestive distress. So I don't know what the animal studies are, but I'm imagining that consuming the sugar alcohols probably do something pretty drastic to an animal's digestion if they do consume it. So that's why they're advised against it. But again, it's okay for us.
Interesting.
Just like propylene glycol is.
Yeah, right. That's true. That's, yeah. And it can't be in the cat or dog food, but we can be in our bodies. I am struck when we talk about artificial sweeteners by the story about the discovery of the first of them. It's really kind of a Mr. Watson, come here, I want you kind of moment.
I learned so much writing this book, and it was such an incredible journey because I tell people, and people in where I live get a chuckle, is that, it's very isolating writing a book.
Yeah.
And so I would plop myself down in a coffee shop and write, and I'd have headphones on listening to something because I needed some noise as I was digging so deep into thought and into research. And then I would find something out, and I literally would gasp, not realizing I was doing that, and people around me would look at me.
Like, is she okay?
Yeah, and honestly, I think the saccharin story was one of those gasping moments where it was compliments of Monsanto when it initially was introduced to market. And it was discovered, though, years before by a scientist who was playing around in a lab, and he spilled something on his hand, and he tasted it, and it was sweet, and boom, there you have it.
But what was he working with?
He was working with various chemicals.
Coal tar was the big one, wasn't it?
Yeah, coal tar. Actually, yes, it was a derivative of coal tar. So he was working with, I don't remember the exact combination, because, when you write a book like this, it's so hard to go back and remember every single detail for every little conversation and every big conversation that you're having. But it was a mixture of, it was done at Johns Hopkins, okay, and it was a derivative of coal tar that he actually accidentally spilled on his hand, and it tasted sweet.
I just can't believe the guy licking his hand, but go ahead.
These are scientists for you. And so it set the stage for the development of saccharin. And that was the first artificial sweetener introduced to market, and has quite a story, actually, because it was introduced to market. It was granted GRAS status, as we were talking about earlier, generally recognized as safe. And then it was taken off of the market in the 70s because there were studies that questioned its safety.
I remember that. There were even jokes on Saturday Night Live. Saccharin, I want you back again.
Yeah, right. I actually had the privilege of watching Saturday Night Live when I was very young.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of went in and out of approval, and now it's in our food. But it's interesting. In Europe, there's a warning label on foods that contain saccharin, but not in our country.
Huh. Go figure. Stephanie Sachs is our guest. Her book is What the Fork Are You Eating? Here's Ruth in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be there. I had a son who had, they thought at first it was Lyme, and they put him on different diets and restricted foods, and it just got worse. He finally decided, I saw on his death certificate, that it was ALS. Is there anything food can do to help that?
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Ruth, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. My heart goes out to you. Terry Walls, who is somebody who lives with multiple sclerosis, has done a lot of work, I also believe, related to ALS. And her information is very interesting. It's WHALS. That's her last name. And, another place where you can find out what's going on is with all of the research with ALS, because I'm not too up to date on that. It's a very, very specific, neurodegenerative disease. But the ice bucket challenge, did you hear about that?
Oh, everybody was aware of that, sure.
Of course. So the woman who started that, she did a wonderful TEDx talk in Boston, I believe. And off the top of my head, I honestly cannot remember her son's name. But he's still living with ALS. And so that's a great resource as well to find out what's going on from a research standpoint. But again, because it's a neurodegenerative disease, oftentimes the approach is a highly anti-inflammatory diet, which is, again, removing all the junk, eating whole foods, and keeping your meals and snacks and everything you're going to consume as pure as it can be.
Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. You know those people who say, are you really going to eat that? That times 10 equals Stephanie Sachs, a chef and nutritionist and radio host and author. Her book is What the Fork Are You Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. The interviewer is from 2015, so we can't take any new questions or comments today. So I want to move on to some of the better-for-you alternatives for some of the things we've been talking about. We spent a fair amount of time on sweeteners. If you do want to avoid sweeteners, if you do want to avoid sugar, and we've talked about all the different things sugar can be called, what are some of the things that you think work best?
You know, I like to call in just the purest sweeteners. Go with pure cane sugar. Go with honey, maple syrup. Those are the, you know, those are the purest from the source. You can also go with, you know, things like a date sugar or
what about agave
nectar? Fruit juice. Agave is fine, too. And again, you want to buy it by a reputable company because there's been a lot of buzz that, you know, agave is cut with corn syrup. So, again, it's there are so many things to look out for. I personally at home, we stick to honey and we stick to maple syrup. And that's pretty much where we stay.
Now, when I look at some of the things in here, like the hydrogenated oils and margarines and things like that, so what do you recommend in the way of things for greasing up a pan to get ready for cooking?
Oh, my gosh. There's olive oil. There's grapeseed oil. There's coconut oil. There's butter. How about a little butter or ghee, which is clarified butter? There's so many ways to do it than genetically modified corn oil, genetically modified generic vegetable oil. There's canola oil that's genetically modified, soy oil. So there are so many ways to grease up your pan without any of the garbage. You know, the hydrogenated oils come more into play when you're looking at a lot of these spreads out there and a lot of baked goods. And there are plenty of better options out there that don't have them. But one thing I will tell people to note is that while at this juncture, trans fats have to be labeled on the nutrition facts label, they can still be in your food if less than 0.5 grams. So the ingredients will always tell you the story of your food. Don't think that the nutrition facts tell you everything, and surely don't believe any of the claims. And I spend a lot of time talking about food label lingo and what to believe and what not to believe. So you're getting these real action tips to make the changes. So I'm not just talking about, okay, go ahead and make all these changes, but not giving you exactly what you need to do. I'm spelling everything out for you in this book, and pantry rehab, and navigating the grocery store, and then we jump in the kitchen and meal rehab.
I want to come back to GMO because you mentioned that. I do want to get where you stand on GMO because it's been a big issue in our part of the world. Oregon just pass a GMO labeling measure, but the county in which our offices are based did pass a no-grow GMO ordinance last year.
I love that. Yeah, my take on GMOs. I think we have been a science experiment for biotech for decades without knowing it. And that's my take. I don't think we know enough. And I personally think that, and also this dialogue has gone on between some very high-level health professionals and myself, that we definitively believe that genetically modified food plays a role in the increased allergies among children, the digestive problems that people are having more and more. I mean, 14 years ago, I was gluten-free for medical reasons. Now everybody's gluten-free. It's the new fad. And why is that? Our wheat technically is not genetically modified, but it goes through a process called mutagenesis that I touch on in the book. So we have a highly adulterated wheat supply, and we're consuming genetically modified ingredients in almost every processed food that we choose to eat, unless it's verified by the non-GMO project or is USDA organic, or we can trust the food producer.
Well, here again, it gets down to labeling, and we do not have labeling laws in this country. And so you're kind of stuck with what you can glean from what's on the label. And as you point out in the pantry rehab section of the book, it's not the best thing in the world to trust in nutrition labels. What's the thing people should really pay the most attention to when they're looking at those?
Well, again, the ingredients tell the story of your food. And any product that boasts multiple labels is a dead giveaway for fake food, in my opinion. One area that I do want to touch on, because I think it is something that's being talked about more and more, are the labels that we see on animal foods. And right in your home state of Oregon, there's a wonderful organization called Animal Welfare Approved, and they go out and they verify farms all over the country who are truly humanely raising animals, where they're raised on pasture, and they're a third-party verification for farms. And so what's happening is we see all these labels like cage-free, pasture-raised,
yeah, it goes on for page after page in the book.
What?
It goes on for page after page in the book.
Oh, yeah. And so you see these labels, and the interesting thing is most of these terms are defined by our government, but they're not regulated by our government. So you have to look to third-party verification, like an animal welfare approved, like a certified humane, even a USDA organic and a certified naturally grown. But for high, high humane welfare, you want animal welfare approved, if that's your thing, and certified humane, because they're the highest humane welfare. And in my opinion, you are what you eat, but you're not only what you eat. You are how they ate, and you are how they were treated. And so I am all for animal food consumption, but highly conscious animal food consumption. And when people say to me, oh, well, we can't afford it, I say, well, cut back on what you're eating, replace it with plant protein, and then buy the highest quality.
So this is where it gets into the it costs too much thing, and you've got some solid recommendations here.
Yeah, I do, because I've spent the past 15 years teaching people one-on-one and in groups how to navigate these challenges. So I know that it's possible. So anybody who comes to me and tells me it's not possible, I have 15 years of examples to tell them it's possible, even people living in low-income communities. And you have to pick and choose your battles. You know, access is an issue for people, time, money. You have to pick and choose your battles. That's why I say in this book, pull from this book what is realistic for you to do. And maybe not focusing on high humane welfare is one of your number ones, but maybe food dye is. Well, that's a huge difference if food dye is.
And not necessarily change your entire intake at once, but figure out what works for you and then consider expanding later on.
Absolutely. You can do it in bits and pieces.
Let's take another call. We have Janet in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephanie Sachs, the author of What the Fork Are You Eating?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question was iodine, the iodized salt. Do people get enough or not enough iodine in their diets?
Generally speaking, people get enough iodine in their diet in this country. We don't really need to worry about that too much. Where you run into people needing more iodine, it is the female population, and it can be pregnant women. And a great way to get natural iodine is just through consuming some kelp, if people are okay with that.
Kelp as in seaweed, basically.
Yeah, mm-hmm. As in seaweed, yeah.
You were talking about in a section on pantry rehab about approaching clients about how to change things in their kitchen. And how reluctant are some of these people to have you look in their refrigerator and cabinets?
Well, it's so funny because one thing I say in the book is that most people would rather me look in their bathrooms or in the top drawer of their dresser than in their pantry. And the beauty about my work is that people come to me when they're ready to make change. So they're open. I'm meeting them where they're at, but they're open. Stephanie, come in and help us change. So it's just a matter of me really understanding where they're at and guiding them in a way that's doable for them and not scaring them away.
So as you go through the pantries and the refrigerator and any other place you store food in your house, there's this bit about reapers and keepers.
Mm-hmm.
How do you separate those?
Right. So what I try to do is focus the idea of separating the Grim Reapers and the Keepers based on the TRT list, so the top-rated Terminator list. So, for example, read your ingredient list. If it has, you know, food dyes, if you see red dye number 40, yellow dye number 5 or 6, which are the three dyes that are primarily in our foods, put that in the Grim Reapers. And that's something you want to pass on. Okay. If your child is a huge fan of those colored, artificially colored sports drinks, you know, have a conversation with your kid. Part of this is about having conversations around food, too. Have a conversation and say, you know what, buddy? Listen, I have two boys, so I'm always talking from that perspective. And, you know, the dyes in here, they're not really good for you. And this is why, because now you can have this dialogue because you have the information in this book. And you can offer little pearls. And they're not good because of this. And say to them, I'll let you drink this, but understand what your choice is. And so I see this, I see progress in this area firsthand because of my kids. I have a 9-year-old who goes around and talks to people about food. Kids and friends of his have stopped eating and drinking certain things because of what he tells them.
Wow. And you had a particular moment, come to think of it, about the food coloring with sports drinks and a really young child at one of the hockey games, didn't you?
Yes. That was, I call that one of my what the fork are you eating moments, where I was at my older son's hockey game, and there was a woman who had an 18-month-old, roughly 18 months, in the stands, and he was hysterical crying. And I'm watching, and I see her pull out his bottle, and she takes red Gatorade and pours red Gatorade into his bottle and gives it to the hysterical child, and the child stops crying. And I was biting my tongue, probably to the point of bleeding, and I get so angry because not at the woman as much as the concept that this woman doesn't know better. So how can I help her? I wanted to go give her a hug and just say, you know what, there are better ways. Can I show you better ways?
So one of the things also that really comes through in the book, and it's in actually the section on top-rated Terminators, is this information that might surprise a few people, which is when something says it's got natural flavorings, that isn't necessarily a great thing.
So I call the world of food flavoring the food CIA. And it's unbelievable. Eric Schlosser, in his book, Fast Food Nation, did a wonderful job of talking about the flavor industry. But just as artificial flavors are made in the lab, so are natural flavors. And while artificial come from synthetic substances, natural come from natural substances, so chemicals extracted, compounds extracted from, let's say, a blueberry. But again, a natural flavor can be made up of multiple compounds, roughly, 40 compounds, to create one palatable natural flavor in a food. And so I use as an example a company like Annie's, where if you pick up their mac and cheese, their boxed mac and cheese, I mean, my kids eat it once in a while. It's a special treat for them. And I'm not opposed to foods like that by any stretch. I work full time. I've got two kids. I've got homework. I've got hockey. I've got so many things that I'm managing. And granted, I have an amazing husband who helps out, thank goodness. But the reality is when you look at their ingredients, their food is flavored with cheese.
Instead of something else.
Instead of cheese flavor, or instead of cheese and artificial flavors, or cheese and natural flavors, or cheese and monosodium glutamate, which is a flavor enhancer. So if there are companies that can do it this way, I always wonder why are so many companies doing it the other way? And it's because it's cheaper. And cheaper means more money for the company.
One of the things I've learned from talking to other people about food in recent years is that the general recommendation that if you're avoiding processed foods, stick to the edges of the store because that's where the fresh food is.
Absolutely. Stick to the edges of the store. But again, I can say that to people until they're blue in the face, but they'll say to me, well, you know what, I don't really love to cook and I don't have the time to cook and my kids love, this can this box this bag this. And I said, okay, where can we create the balance?
And you find it. Well, there's a lot of recommendations in the book and even recipes, things we didn't even talk about, a lot more to the book than we did talk about today. It's called What the Fork Are You Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. Stephanie Sachs wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Stephanie, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much.